When a patient hears they have cancer, it's often followed up with an appointment to begin radiation. But new research shows that more radiation for colorectal cancer patients is not the best option.
But clearly, the vast majority of patients in this specific group of patients did not need radiation. And so obviously we spare them the immediate toxicities as well as the long-term complications of radiation.
Our guest today is Dr. Alan Vinook, who holds the Madden Family Distinguished Professorship in Medical Oncology and Translational Research at the University of California at San Francisco.
In the last decade, there's been a stunning increase in incidence in young people. And so it turns out that young people are less likely to go to the doctor for anything, let alone for rectal bleeding. And even when they go to the doctors tend to dismiss it as, well, it's not cancer, so hemorrhoids or whatever. And so we're seeing, unfortunately, young people who, even those who've reported earlier symptoms, tend to be more advanced by the time we recognize the cancer.
And this is Conversations on Healthcare.
Dr. Alan Vinook, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
In March is when we mark Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Before we get into the results of your breakthrough study, I want to ask you to explain the typical treatment for colorectal cancer. Its radiation treatment and pelvic radiation in particular has many side effects.
Right. So colon cancer, which is cancer above the, out of the pelvis, is really not, radiation is not used. But for rectal cancer, which is cancer of the last 12 centimeters of the large intestine, chemotherapy and radiation and surgery have all been used typically for optimal management. Radiation has been popular and used for the last 30 or 40 years, perhaps to some extent because it's difficult for surgeons to get good radial margins in their surgical field when they go in to operate in the close confines of the pelvis. So that's sort of the rationale. But it's quite true for patients with rectal cancer. Historically, they get chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery with all the consequences from those treatments.
Well, Dr. Vinook, I believe the New England Journal of Medicine recently published your research that suggested or demonstrated that less may be more when it comes to treating the patients. Now we're speaking just about rectal cancer, and show that many patients do just as well without receiving the radiation. Tell us about that. What are you seeing?
Right. Well, this was a study that we designed probably 10 or 12 years ago. It was run by Dr. Deborah Schrag, who at the time was at the Dana-Farber, now at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And the premise was that if we chose our patients carefully and built in protection to make sure we weren't putting them at risk, we thought that a good population really were being overtreated by the use of radiation. We think in many cases, cancer care evolves where we do more to get the best result we can and then start going backwards in terms of taking away therapy. So in this case, we designed a study in patients who we thought were the best candidates and likely did need radiation, patients, let's say, with high rectal cancers, not cancers near where the sphincter function of the bowel is. Patients who would normally have surgery and radiation and chemotherapy altogether, we thought we could design a trial that would just give patients chemotherapy upfront as a randomization. And then half the patients would get the standard treatment of chemo, radiation, and then surgery. So we did the study designing in such a way that they got chemotherapy. We built in the protection that if they hadn't had marked reduction in the tumor after four cycles of chemotherapy, we would go right to radiation and then surgery. So we didn't put them at risk for failing to cure a disease that was curable. And we found that, in fact, by doing that, as a study over time demonstrated that there was no difference in overall survival, but most patients in this population did not need radiation. About 9% of the patients who we started out without doing radiation, we did add radiation because didn't get what we thought was enough of a benefit from chemotherapy. But clearly, the vast majority of patients in this specific group of patients did not need radiation. And so obviously we spare them the immediate toxicities as well as the long-term complications of radiation.
All right. I'm a little dense on this, but just to be 100% clear on the question, you and your colleagues are convinced that there's no compromise in patient survival or the risk of recurrent cancer over time with less radiation?
Well, so I think being convinced is different than being confident. So the way I would put it is that you certainly need more follow-up to be certain that we haven't, maybe there might be longer-term consequences. But by statistical analysis, we found non-inferiority, right? So you can look for one treatment to be better than the other. Actually, it's harder to show that something is non-inferior. And we definitely have shown that in regards to local control and progression, early progression, there's no difference. It's conceivable after 10 or 15 years, we might see a survival difference, I suppose, but no evidence so far. And we've got about 5 years of average follow-up on all these patients.
You know, I'm going to take us up a level, and we'll probably go back and forth a little bit between treatment and prevention in the show, if you'll bear with us. But you've, I think, provided an important message for our listeners about maybe separating out colon cancer and rectal cancer. Take just a moment to share with our listeners, what are the presenting signs and symptoms of colon cancer versus rectal cancer, risk factors, and we'll talk about screening a little bit further on.
Sure. So the general sense of these, of colon and rectal cancer, is a change in bowel habits. And most commonly, let's say bleeding, finding blood in the stools would be the most disconcerting and most thing that is most likely to signal that there's a colon or rectal cancer, although most rectal bleeding is not associated with colon or rectal cancer, but it certainly should raise your index of suspicion. Family history is very important. If you've had one first degree relative, you're at greater risk. If you've had two first degree relatives, you're at very high risk for colon or rectal cancer. And again, the symptoms are often dismissed by patients. So either because they want to ignore them or they just don't think it's a big deal.
Right.
So bowel, you know, intermittent diarrhea and constipation, some crampy pain, for example. As I said, bleeding being one of the most common things that's noticed. The problems we're having now is distribution of patients who are getting colon and rectal cancer has changed. In the last decade, there's been a stunning increase in incidence in young people. And so it turns out that young people are less likely to go to the doctor for anything, let alone for rectal bleeding. Mm-hmm. And even when they go to the doctors tend to dismiss it as, well, it's not cancer, so hemorrhoids or whatever. And so we're seeing, unfortunately, young people who, even those who've reported earlier symptoms, tend to be more advanced by the time we recognize the cancer. So this is it's a sort of a changing paradigm in terms of who we have to think about and our index of suspicion mm-hmm. for who's going to get colon or rectal cancer.
The American Cancer Society and the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force, which we sort of think about as the gold standard, recommend that colorectal cancer screening begin at age 45 for asymptomatic average population. But the American College of Physicians says the screening should start at 50. I think this is conflicting guidance to the public, and some of your fellow physicians say it does a disservice to have such confusion. What advice do you have?
Well, I agree it does do a disservice. The challenge, and I think the American Cancer Society's change from 50 to 45 a couple of years ago was based on modeling, where they recognize that there's a greater incidence in younger patients who are developing colon and rectal cancer. And they sort of thought about how many people this included and what was realistically achievable. I'm not sure that 45 or 50 is the right time benchmark. As I said, we're seeing a lot of patients in the age range of 35 to 40, and you're not going to find cancer early if you don't screen until 45. I think we're missing the boat a little bit on this approach of colonoscopy to screen, or even fecal occult blood. I think what we have to do is determine if there aren't some circulating factors that tell us who's at greater risk for having colon or rectal cancer, sort of enrich the population for patients likelier to have the disease, and then try to screen that population. Because I think clearly a global strategy, you know, you just can't do enough colonoscopies to screen all the 40 and 35 and 45-year-olds. So I think we should do what is achievable rather than what we wish we could do. I must say, in our approach to screening people over the age of 50, we've been quite successful in really markedly decreasing the risk of colon and rectal cancer in patients over the age of 50. even if the penetration of that screening is maybe only 60% of patients get the proper approach and are checked for the risk of, for the possibility of colorectal cancer, that's enough of an intervention to decrease the incidence quite markedly in patients above that age. So we could do do the same with younger people, except you just can't be doing colonoscopies on all the young people that are around.
Well, we can certainly speak from the primary care space, community health center space, taking care of large populations of individuals for whom screening may not be the highest priority. And we'd love to give you a chance to maybe just speak to the value of doing the at-home tests that we now have available. Certainly, they've improved over the many years that I've been in practice. What can we do to get more people to engage in doing a screening test at home at whatever age level we set as the appropriate one for screening in the absence of family history?
We'll let you add. That's a $64,000 question.
I hope you have the answer.
Maybe $64 million question given inflation. I don't know. It's penetrating the population of patients and people telling them, getting them to believe that they should do this is very difficult. It's always stunning to me how hard that is, but let alone trying to change their diet or do other things that might have a bearing on this. I think it's incumbent on primary care physicians to actually emphasize this and push this. And my disappointment is that many primary care physicians don't really see this as a focal point. But I don't know. I don't know how to get convince people that there are these sort of unpleasant things. Let's say is taking a sample of stool and putting it on a card. Like exactly why that's so unpleasant, I don't know. But it's very hard to convince people to do that. The tests are not perfect, but certainly they'll help. They would help to identify some patients who could avoid bad disease and early death because of a cancer. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do think is lax is. It's interesting how many patients we'll see for second opinion who've been diagnosed with colon cancer, and you look through the records and nobody's taken a family history. And that's at least a place where we should all be starting.
You know, I want to pull the thread on your comment about diet and what's the impact between a vegetarian diet and other diets in terms of contracting colorectal cancer?
Well, certainly the so-called Western diet, which is like, let's say, burgers and fries, that's not good. That it clearly increases the incidence of colon and rectal cancer. In contrast, a non-Western diet, fruits, veggies, those people who have those diets have less incidence. But it's not absolute. One of the things I'd say is, for example, the change in the young patients getting colon and rectal cancer, these are not people necessarily with different diets. They're vegans, there are triathletes, there are all sorts of there are people who would, you think, not have the standard risk factors for cancer who are getting cancer at a young age. But as with everything else, smoking, for example, is a risk factor for colon cancer. As I said, high fatty foods, red meat, those are all things to avoid. But none of them are, patients obviously follow all those rules and still can get colon cancer. I think the driving force is probably heritable risk that we can't quantify or don't understand that is the greatest cause of colon cancer.
Well, Dr. Vennick, we hear so much about in many disease states the ability to maybe transition from some of these tests like the colonoscopy or the at-home test. Is there any hope of a blood test marker at some point down the road, or is the research underway in that area?
The research is underway, and I think we're closing in on something that might actually be able to tell us who has polyps. I think we're close to that. Now, part of the problem is as appropriately, it's been studied mostly in older individuals like you and me, well, at least like me.
That's okay. You can include me, too.
And
all
and
of us.
So, right. And so looking in the population of, let's say, above 55 or 60, and identifying maybe circulating factors, circulating DNA for tumor DNA, for example, that might be a handle on finding people who have early cancer. Certainly, we're seeing that there are a number of diagnostic tests that are out there that are being used and not really by any means incredibly effective, but we are finding some early cases. I think as we hone down on that, we're likely to find a series of DNA findings that might tell us who's at risk. The problem is going to be understanding if what we learn in 55 and 60 year olds will apply to 35 and 40 year olds, because we've been relatively successful in getting screening colonoscopy into patients above the age of 50. And the young patients, where that's really where we need major strides. And I think a blood test would go a long way towards helping us figure out who we should be focusing our screening on. But we need to do the work to prove in the young populations. Diagnostic companies are doing that. There are probably a dozen different diagnostics companies working with amazing technology to look for genetics, cancer genes, et cetera. And I do think that we're closing in on something that'll be practical and useful down the road.
Are you talking about some gene editing CRISPR technology that might sort of be able to be applied here that, you know, as we move down the road with more understanding?
Well, I think, you know, CRISPR, it's a good question. I think possibly CRISPR will have more of a role in replacing genes or getting, putting genes in that for function, loss of function. Mm-hmm. I mean, the story about sickle cell is kind of amazing.
Right, in terms of absolutely.
I'm thinking more about looking at a fingerprint, let's say a series of molecular features that may characterize an early cancer. And if you can find cells that have particular mutational patterns, I mean, it's like finding a needle in the haystack, but it's remarkable what the technology can do. There's a test, for example, if a patient has a cancer, you can create a probe that will find a cell, a bit of DNA in the blood of that patient that has the same molecular features as the cancer. It's just astounding technology, but
is that also being fueled by some of the AI stuff that's in the background on looking at these large data sets being able to call through them?
And I think the answer ultimately will be in AI, because my bet is we already know that we would know what some of these risks are, but we're not smart enough to figure it out. But I think to that end, I think the most important step we all need to take, and one of the things we're pushing for, is for there to be a single public database. Mm-hmm. Of all the information we gather on patients at risk or patients with cancer. And we're advocating for it. Obviously, the privacy and other issues, but I think that overall the benefit, and this is worldwide, because interestingly, the increased incidence in colon and rectal cancer in young people is not just in the U.S., mm-hmm. it's everywhere. And so there's obviously a changing dynamic that is probably an explanation for if we had enough smarts to figure it out.
I was just thinking, Dr. Vinick, that we're kind of traveling in the conversation from what would seem like the simplest thing in the world, you know, do that stool card, as I still call it, the at-home test, to AI and technologies that we're still hoping for and don't yet have it in the diagnosis and treatment. And I wonder, thinking back to when the Affordable Care Act was passed and how excited I was that finally, if something was on the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force list, it would be covered by insurance, no questions asked, no deductible, no copay. That seemed to me like it was going to be a real game changer for cancers like colorectal cancer, but we haven't seen that. So I'd like to ask you, in your work with colleagues and conferences and your research, any groups that are really getting it right in terms of getting populations of patients to do the test? What have you seen? CDC have anything to show us? Do you have anything to share with us?
Well, no. I mean, that's really it's been disappointing. There are some examples where the testing has been really very effective. For example, the state of Delaware, maybe 10, 12 years ago, of course, Delaware has like one congressman and two senators and the governor. They all know each other and they sort of exchange jobs. But it's a state that more or less is dominated by a couple of employers. And the state of Delaware, which had a very high risk of death in African Americans from colon and rectal cancer, set out to see if they couldn't eliminate colon and rectal cancer. And actually, by in-depth penetration of the population with the aid of the city governments and the major employers, they almost eliminated colon cancer over the course of a couple of years. Really astonishing. And that's an example of what can be done if you have a will and you have a relatively captive audience. And so the answer is it's doable, but you really have to mean it. And I think it's hard, it's not easy. And some populations, let's say with captive patients, let's say HMOs, they should be able to do it, but even getting those people who are there, who are limited in where they can go, the compliance with these screening tests is just not adequate so far. So I think it's doable, but it really takes a concerted effort by a lot of people.
Delaware, Maryland always has sort of advances going on. There's something in the DNA and the water there. You know, I do want to pull the thread on your talk about special populations. And as you know, 90% survival rate with early detection and treatment. But really, these disparities in this population that we're very concerned about, and I know you are as well, is particularly Black Americans, American Indians, Alaskan Natives, underserved Americans, disproportionately affected by disease. What do you see as the solution to closing these gaps? Obviously, you got an exemplar in Delaware, but what other thoughts do you have about the reaching this very important population?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've taken a variety of strategies at UCSF where I'm located, where we reach out into the community. We try to have a presence in the African-American community. We have a large Hispanic population. It's very hard to make inroads. Part of it is maybe trust. I think there's a fear amongst many populations that we're jerking them around. We're not really trying to help them. Mm-hmm. Some of it is cultural. Some things that people won't talk about. We're trying, I think, but it's been hard. One of the things we are now doing is going into the communities with people who speak their language, people who look like the people in the communities, trying to get the message across. Very difficult to do. There's years of, I think, mistrust and years of neglect that it's hard to fix. You know, it's one thing to, let's say, if you're looking to do prostate cancer screening with a blood test for PSA, let's say, you can go to where African-American men might congregate, wherever that might be in a community, let's say an African, a largely Black community. But doing screening for colon cancer is not as simple. Mm-hmm. I can't really say we've been very successful at it. We're trying. Mm-hmm. But I think our current belief is that we need to have people of the members of the community try to do the recruiting or the convincing that it's worth doing.
Well, that's certainly a large focus for our research institute as part of the Moses Weizmann Health System, which is very focused on health equity, health disparities, and making sure we reach into our population. So we'll keep you posted on a research in that area. And it is always a tragedy when there's a late diagnosis where the earlier diagnosis would have predicted a better outcome. But we always look to see whether there are breakthrough drugs. I know in late 2023, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new drug to treat refractory metastatic colorectal cancer. What are we learning about that? And are there other things in the pipeline that you see coming when treatment is the option?
Right. So the drug you're talking about is a drug called fruquintinib, which is an oral inhibitor of a vascular factor that just need to grow. And these new drugs are helpful, certainly for some patients, they'll get meaningful benefit. On average, though, I think if we want to be bold, we look for something that's more dramatic or more impactful. Yeah. The one thing that's been very frustrating about colon and rectal cancer has been the lack of efficacy of the immune therapies, right? If you look at what's changed the world of cancer in the last decade, it's been the checkpoint inhibitor, the understanding of how the cancer sort of takes the body's mechanism for protecting itself from autoimmune disease and hides, the cancer can hide behind these factors. And so new immunotherapies that are able to get around that blockade have changed the face of melanoma, of lung cancer, lots of cancers, not so much in colon and rectal cancer, except for the small subset of patients who have what's called Lynch syndrome or MSI high, have microsatellite unstable cancers. The real trick in colon and rectal cancer to make a difference will be figuring out how the immune system can be somehow alerted or made able to recognize the presence of colon and rectal cancer. And that's our focus for research, and so far not the progress we'd like. There are a couple hints that we're on the way, but so far colon rectal cancer has remained really impossible to get at in that way. Maybe not surprising if you think about the colon is bathed in bacteria and fungi and viruses, all sorts of flora in this, what's called the microbiome. And so the body has sort of somehow or other basically protected the colon from the immune system, because if the immune system were attacking all these foreigners, we'd be sick all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that that may be the reason that these immune system doesn't affect cancers, because there's the immune system just isn't as active in the colon. That's sort of the practical implications of how our bodies work.
Well, we know there's a lot of work going on in the microbiome world. Jackson Labs up the road from where we are and others around the country are working on it. But they all work on it because we've got federal government support, or we hope we do, because it plays such a large role in cancer research funding. But we're on the verge of another budget shutdown. I'm wondering, how do you see cancer funding, and how well you think the dollars will be spent or are being spent?
Well, that's a moving target. I actually sit on a committee with the American Society of Clinical Oncology that spends a couple of days every 3 or 4 months on Capitol Hill, and of course getting the folks on Capitol Hill interested in this. And good luck. I mean, there's not a lot of interest now. The new head of the NIH is Monica Bertagnolli, yeah, who is a cancer surgeon, who actually was one of the principals behind the study we talked about right off the bat, the rectal cancer study. She was one of the co-authors. She chaired the group that led that study. So the people get it, and I think they understand where the focus needs to be. But having said that, we worry always about the cuts. To me, the greatest danger is that we're going to lose our young population, the young scientists who will continue on, from people like me when I move on, who's going to be carrying the baton, and the poor funding or inadequate funding going forward puts those individuals at risk for whether they can spend their careers doing what I've been able to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's my greatest fear. I do think we're on the cusp of big advances because, if nothing else, AI should give us the ability to figure out things that we've been unable to figure out so far. But we have to have folks still engaged to make those discoveries.
Well, Dr. Vanook, we wish you much success in your ongoing research, and also want to thank you for all of the care and commitment that you've made throughout your career in this area. And we want to thank both you for joining us, but also our audience for being here and being part of this important conversation. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. And as always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Dr. Vanook, thank you again so much for your important work and for this conversation.
Thanks for giving me the chance. Take care, everybody.
That's great. Continued success.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.